Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number, as always. Before we go into the starters, I want to remind people I would look for help from you in remembering. I remember, it must be at least 25 years ago, attending and broadcasting from the unveiling of a memorial to the Stardust victims in the grounds of Beaumont Hospital in Dublin. As you know, Beaumont Hospital was not built in 1981. If it was, it would be the nearest big building to the Stardust in many ways. But in fairness to the authorities at Beaumont, they decided it was a small garden. It's not accessible, but you can look into it. And they put up a plaque which had that piece I read last week at the end of Thursday's programme, They Should Not Grow Old, as those of us who grow old, and at the setting of the sun, you know the piece. And then on the wall, there was, I think, about six plaques which with each of the 48 victims named. Now, the reason I remember one was because of the power of the families, and this is a good, I'd say, 30 years from, hoping people might remember the exact date. It's still there. If you go into Beaumont Hospital, you go past the porter's desk and reception area in front of you, you stick to the right and you go down that corridor towards the canteen, and just before you come to the canteen, you look through glass, and there is the foliage and the plaques on the wall. I don't know what condition it's in. I suspect, given it's in a hospital, is very well looked after. But what I remember about that day was, one, the families, and two, Christy Dignam. Unless I'm wrong, Christy Dignam came out and spoke and sang. And again, it's just come to me now, I think Christy sang Imagine, that John Lennon song. And it was, as per usual with Christy, it stopped the nation, or whoever was listening to the Gay Bourne show at the time, which would have been a lot of people, and moved greatly the families and the survivors in attendance. But I also remember one thing that day, and I'm anxious to find out if it's ever been rectified. Of the 48 names, one of them was spelt incorrectly, and it was Josephine Glenn. And the family said to me afterwards, I had nothing to do, I was only a little boy reporter. Josephine's name was spelled G-L-E-N-N. Her correct spelling is G-L-E-N. Now, it was nobody's fault, I'm not saying that. These things happen. But the hurt of that family, when they saw their child's name, Josephine was only 16, spelled incorrectly. I'd love to know if it's been rectified, if anyone's in and around Beaumont at the minute. I'd love to know that memorial, because they will be talking about memorials today. And in fairness, Beaumont Hospital did one long before, obviously the relatives did one up in Bonnybrook, but long before the state are doing what they're doing today, Beaumont Hospital did it. But I'd love to know if that little, that little typo in the one hand, but had such meaning and upset for the family when they saw Josephine's name spelt incorrectly, has been fixed. And also, I suspect the answer is yes when I ask, is the little area being tended to and looked after? Joe O'Brien. Joe, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
And I only met a firefighter this morning, one of your colleagues, Noel Cunningham. I think he was a DO, a district officer at the time. You were one of the first firefighters at the scene in February 14th, 1981. What station were you based in, Joe?
I was in the North Strand Fire Station at that time, Joe. And as we start, I just want to say this is, it's my recollection. I'm not here to speak for any of the lads or for the fire brigade. It's just my recollection of the night. And, you know, when we turned out on the night, Joe, Kilbardic had arrived just ahead of us. They were the first attending appliance, and those lads were going about their business as we pulled into the car park area, and it was absolutely pandemonium. I remember looking up at the roof and seeing that the fire had vented the building through the roof in two different locations, and my immediate kind of feeling was, sure, it's that well-established a fire at this stage, surely everybody is out.
Okay.
Little did I know what we were to encounter.
And reminding people that the roof, the Stardust, was a converted factory. It wasn't a purpose-built public venue. It was a converted factory, and the roof was a factory roof. Those apexed with the valleys and the apexes, and I presume it was just corrugated. So the flames were coming through the corrugated iron or whatever. The flames were coming through the roof, and you presumed at that stage the fire is so involved that everyone would have exited. But that, when did you realise that was not the case?
Well, immediately when we pulled up at the exits, Joe, we could see that there were still people coming out of them to our left as we approached the building. And we approached the building then and parked to the right of the building as we drove down the forecourt of the car park. And then we realised, look, there's still people in here. And the lads from Kilbarrick number 6 station, as we called them, the lads from number 6 are already getting down to work. They had already seen the immediacy of what was required, and they were in the building effecting rescues and getting people out, you know. So we joined in that at that stage. And I didn't fully realise the number of people who are still in the building, because although the fires do, if you like, they're dynamic scenarios, and they happen very, very quickly. They're very unpredictable in the way they can, if you like, engulf a building. But given that the roof space in the Stardust was a common roof space, there was no compartmentation or separation in it to contain any fire in the immediate zone or area. So it just spread across the roof. And I know I jumped the gun a little bit here maybe, but the narrative, Joe, as you're well aware, at the time was that this fire was arson, that, you know, some of the kids at the disco had started this fire. But the fire was not well involved when we arrived. My feeling always was that the fire had come down from the ceiling. I had that feeling about it, that the fire had dropped down from the ceiling onto that infamous seated area.
Yeah.
And that's where it started, in the seated area, instead of anybody physically setting a match or a lighter to it, that the fire had fallen down from the ceiling, which was, in fact, the roof area or the roof space where the fire was fully involved. And that was my impression after the fire, thinking about it. How the hell did it? And then listening to the survivors and their accounts of getting out and the intense heat that they experienced from above them. You know, that always kind of confirmed for me what I felt was a probable cause, whatever wording you want to use. So for the thing to come out in the end, Joe, and last week when you were talking about it, and you kept using the phrase about the unlawful killing, you know, it really kind of drove it home to me. And I said to myself, well, you know, that appears to have been the way that, for me, the whole thing came about.
Okay.
Yeah,
stay with us, Joe O'Brien, former Dublin Fire. Yeah. Tommy Bruin, former TD for Dublin North East. Tommy, I know over the years you were campaigning, you're from the area, you've represented that area since the 1990s, and you're former Labour Party TD. But Tommy, how do you look on today?
Good afternoon, Joe. Yeah. Well, I suppose it's like Karen Barrett, I think, Carol Barrett said earlier on, that it's a kind of bittersweet day, I suppose, because last Thursday was a wonderful vindication of the, you know, the families of the 48 people who died, of their families, and the nearly 200 who were seriously injured. Indeed, the whole 840 or so who were in the Stardust on that very tragic St. Valentine's morning. So it's a vindication of that, but it's also, of course, the sad memory again of those who died, who didn't get a chance to live their lives, have families, have careers, possibly mm-hmm. grandparents now. So there's a massive sense of loss as well, I think. But one of satisfaction, I suppose, that the 43-year campaign has finally ended with. Hopefully with we'll hear the Taoiseach's speech yeah. in a few minutes, but hopefully ended with this public apology and also obviously with the verdict of the second inquest.
And Tommy, obviously, you're in your early 30s, I think, in 1981. I know you're a teacher on the north side of Dublin. Do you remember the night?
I actually lived. I'm actually Joe originally. I'm like you. I'm one of the lost tribes of the north side. I'm actually from. I come outside Clondalkin, so we used to play your guys in Ballyar and hurling and football and so on. So I came over just to work on the north side just after the disaster happened. Yeah, a few months later. Yeah. So, but I very quickly, because I was involved with the Labour Party, I got to know obviously Chrissy, Antoinette, and John Keegan.
Yeah.
Gertie Barrett, Breed McDermott, Eugene Kelly, Willie Mulvey, Jimmy Dunn, all the people, in fact, who were involved, the core group over the years yeah. in campaigning for justice and closure for the victims of Stardust.
And Tommy, what is your frame on why those families came up against a brick wall all the time? Because you proposed motions in the Dáil. Why were they knocked yeah. back? Given what we're hearing today and the last week.
Yeah, well it's just, so sad. I mean, even as late as 2017,
yeah.
I forward a motion asking for a commission investigation under the McDowell Act of 2004. And, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, including the current Taoiseach, who's hopefully getting up to apologise now, and ministers like Finian McGrath, like they all voted against us. They voted us down. And that was really incredibly disappointing. I suppose, as has been said, it was people from a working class suburb from the greater Coolock area who were not given the same kind of attention and respect as other areas. I mean, it has been well said, I think, already that if this had happened possibly on the south side of Dublin or in other areas, that, there would have been mm-hmm. a different kind of response. Indeed, if you read the Keane report, of course, it's astonishing because for most of the conclusion, they're saying that the cause may never be known. And then they suddenly came up with this terrible slur on our area of arson, you know, which it took 25 years to get out of the record. And to be corrected by Dáil Éireann when I read the 48 names of the victims into the Dáil record.
And then it's worth, I was only a student at the time. I said, as I attended the tribunal, the Keane Tribunal and the Law Society every single day, because I was writing about it in the student magazine. And I remembered yeah. John Courtney, the murder squad detective who got a bad reputation or a difficult reputation afterwards. He was in charge of the investigation. He stood up and he said, I have looked at the 1,800 statements we've taken. There is no logic to this argument about, because the Butterleys were obviously, they were fighting for the arson verdict so they could claim compensation, which they did get, yeah, as you know. Yeah. And he said, yeah. I have found no evidence whatsoever of arson. I have discounted, I've looked at a number of theories that were put forward before Younford is on the roof. I have discounted all of them. Discounted them. And John Courtney, whatever people think of him, he's the man who caught Malcolm McArthur. He was very, very smart and on the ball when it came to going through. So he told that tribunal there's no evidence of arson, but the phrase that it fell on, and the phrase that was carved in granite at the end of that was the probable cause was arson, and that's what. But is it more than that, Tommy? About why? Like I'm remembering 1981, and I think again that's why people need to read their history. 1981 was a horrific year in this country,
yeah,
Tommy.
Yeah, yeah.
The hunger strikes, the deaths, the funerals, yeah, Maggie yeah, Thatcher, yeah. Charlie yeah. Coffey, the yeah. Stardust. If you go, just look in Wikipedia. Even I asked listeners at 1981, yeah. and you'll see the horror of what
and
we
were. The renewal of emigration as well, Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
And people, we thought we wouldn't see that again. Yeah. So it was a desperate era.
And Tommy, yeah. you also want to praise the Attorney General at the time, Seamus Wolfe.
That's right.
He was the one who said, "Yes, we will have another inquest."
That's right, in September of 2019. I mean, that was wonderful. And I know Lee Bradker had already asked him to review. I'd also like to say, by the way, Joe, first of all, to thank yourself for your extraordinary work in this in highlighting the cause down through the years. And I'd also like to mention a few other journalists.
Yeah, please do.
In particular, so, the two brilliant young Northside journalists, Tony McCulloch, the editor of the Northside People, and Neil Feddison, Neil Feddison of the Sunday World. Yeah. As you know, on the 20th anniversary, they published They Never Came Home,
Incredible.
The start of the story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was the first major work which totally challenged the conclusion of Keane. I felt, in fact, it raised very, very serious issues, which we pursued over the following decade.
And
so Tony,
it's typically your generosity, Tommy, for mentioning the Northside people did incredible work. And Jack, Jack Gleeson and all the crew up there were so diligent. Yeah. Tommy,
can I just also say your own colleague,
Rita O'Reilly.
You made it. Your colleagues on the news programmes as well, and indeed Charlie Bird down through the years.
And I remember
also
Claire Doigning persevering with a documentary, a drama documentary, which was also very, very powerful. We'll go over to the Dáil. The Taoiseach hasn't risen yet in the Dáil, but he's about to do so. Let's go. Catherine Connolly is in the Count Carlos chair. Catherine Connolly,
I just want to say, Cad Míle Fáilte Romhaibh Go Léir. It's in touch.
That is a standing ovation for the relatives who are in the public gallery. The public gallery can hold about 120 people. I'm told the relatives were offered two tickets, two places each. Here is the Taoiseach has risen.
I want to join with you beginning today by welcoming to the House the Stardust families who are gathered here with us in the chamber and in the gallery of Dáil Éireann. I know there have been many, many times when you thought this day would never come. Over far too many, many years. I know that you were forced to endure a living nightmare, which began when your loved ones were so cruelly snatched from you in a devastating fire. Their unfinished stories became your story, the defining story of your lives and the lives of your parents and other family members who left this life before ever seeing justice. I am deeply sorry that you were made to fight for so long that they went to their graves never knowing the truth. Today we say formally and without any equivocation, we are sorry. We failed you when you needed us the most. From the very beginning, we should have stood with you, but instead, we forced you to stand against us. 48 young people lost their lives in the Stardust disaster. Many more were injured, and even more still had their lives broken and shattered forever. When I met with you in government buildings last Saturday, you reminded me of another time when four of your family members waited for days in the cold security hut, protesting your exclusion and hoping for access. I truly hope that the days since last Thursday have marked a turning point. And here today, in Dáil Éireann, we finally begin to put things right. To bring you in from the cold and end the neglect of 43 years waiting and fighting for the only thing you ever wanted, the truth. Nothing else, no other agenda, just the truth. I hope this is a moment when the state, which rubbed salt in your terrible wounds, starts to help you heal. You asked me to try to really understand your experience, to really feel your pain, and to immerse myself in your world as you set out in your eloquent pen portraits to the inquest. There I found not only terrible anguish and unimaginable heartbreak, but also love, joy, laughter, personalities, promise, potential, slagging, messing, pride, dignity, talent, innocence, and the deep abyss of loss and loneliness. On February the 13th, 1981, 48 daughters and sons, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, cousins and in-laws, uncles and aunts, neighbours, friends and co-workers went out to the Stardust on the night of the dancing competition and never came home. For their families, in the nightmare that was to follow, their loved ones not only lost their lives, they lost their identities. They were much, much more than numbers. They were bright, beautiful people. They had plans. They had dreams. They had their whole lives ahead of them. Today, as their families did in their pen portraits to the Stardust Inquest, we remember each of them. Michael Barrett, who was working that night as an assistant DJ. He was wise beyond his years. He had an infectious laugh. He was 17 years old. Richard Bennett, who loved the horses and took on the role of breadwinner for his family, described as an angel in disguise. He was 17. Carol Bissett, a singer in the choir, a girl guide, quiet in her ways, much loved by all. She was 18. Jimmy Buckley, the life of every party, who loved hurling and had won a competition for his Elvis impression. Father figure, brother, hero. He was 23. Paula Byrne, always the peacemaker. She loved to draw, was the epitome of kindness. She was 19. Caroline Carey, a talented Irish dancer who took up disco dancing. A Dublin City Council clerical officer who'd recently found out she was going to be a mother. Her family asked me to tell this house today that this baby was the 49th victim of the Stardust tragedy. Caroline was 17. John Colgan, Johnny, always upbeat. He lit up every room and performed the Hucklebuck as his party piece. He was going to be an uncle. He was 21. Jacqueline Croker, a heart of gold, who brought music into her family's lives on her red record player and used her wages to dress and treat her brothers and sisters. She was 18. Liam Dunn, training to be a butcher, which he loved, with a passion for music. He was a loving boy with many friends. He was 18. Michael Farrell, his family's bundle of joy. He worked at Cadbury, a dapper young man who always tried to look his best. He was a deep thinker, a diarist. He was 26. Michael French, horsey, an auto electrician, and the rock of his family, a role model who worked hard to share his wages and thought of everyone else before himself. He was 18. David Flood, a rocker at heart who loved the guitar and was known for his Jagger swagger. He never missed a day of work and he had all of life's possibilities ahead of him. He was 18. Thelma Fraser, gentle, kind, loved Friday nights and disco moves, remembered by her brothers and her sisters for her treats, her hugs, her kisses. She was 20. Josephine Glenn, quiet, gentle, always smiling and happy, a second mam to her brothers and sisters. She left school to help support her family. She was 16. Michael Griffiths, happy, outgoing, with a great, great work ethic and a generous nature. He loved family occasions. He loved Christmas and could always be heard laughing, singing, playing music. He was 18. Robert Hillock, Bobby. Outgoing, hardworking. He loved football and boxing. He was very close to his late brother Bill. He was 20. Brian Hobbs. His sister was known as his Mammy Pat. He was academically inclined. He excelled at Kettering College, winning a gold medal for Ireland in competition. He was ambitious. He was going places. He was 21. Eugene, Huey Hogan, a skilled carpenter, a sharp dresser with a beautiful voice who could hit the high notes, a loving, caring father. He was 24. Myrta Kavanagh, caring, kind, good-natured. He was a heating insulator who looked after his father. He loved the Dubs and Man United. He was 27. Martina Keegan, not just a daughter and a sister, but a best friend and a confidant. She dreamed of being a model. She was studious and hardworking. She was 16. Mary Keegan, beautiful inside and out. Shy at heart, but very fun-loving and sociable. A teacher to her younger siblings. She excelled at school and work. She was 19. Robert Kelly, nicknamed Spiky for his hairstyle. He worked on the B&I boats and loved it. He was a lover of music and embroidery. He was 17. Mary Kennedy, warm, caring, lively and fiercely protective, dancing as soon as she could walk. Her personality and her style were as bright as her smile. She was 17. Mary Kenny, popular, kind, funny, passionate about fashion and dancing, a fan of Leeds United. She'd just turned 19. Margaret Kiernan, a friend to all who loved sport and loved socialising, loved to sing Roxanne, and who dreamt of a happy future in a house next door to her best friend Deirdre. She was 18. Sandra Lawless, happy, kind, funny, selfless, a Girl Guide leader, a swimmer who won awards for life-saving. She loved hiking and camping in the Dublin mountains. She was 18. Francis Lawler, an army man with a love of style. He'd great leadership skills and he never liked to leave his beautiful baby Lisa. He was 25. Maureen Lawler, a loving and devoted mother to Lisa. Full of dreams for the future, she shared an interest in fashion with her husband Francis. He's always immaculately dressed. She was 26. Paula Lewis was her mother's right-hand woman and her father's pride and joy. She was a second mother to her siblings and her little sister's roommate. She was 19. Eamon Lockman, a protector of his brothers and sisters who remember the crossbars on his racer, a car enthusiast, a music lover with a deep laugh. He was 18. Donna Mahon, a lovely person who loved her job working in the newsagents, meeting people and being part of the community. She had plans to go to Santa Ponsa for her 18th birthday. She was 17. Helena Mangan, kind, caring, loving, brave, strong. Her daughter Samantha was the centre of her life. She loved to dance. She was 22. George McDermott, a gentle music lover with a cheeky grin. He loved to bop and playing cards with his pals. He was 18. Marcella McDermott, happy, singing and dancing with the most gentle and kind nature, especially with children. She was 16. William McDermott, Willie, a gentle giant with a beautiful smile, soft-voiced, witty, caring, kind. He loved the weekend, the Dubliners, and being on Hill 16. He was 22. Julie MacDonald, caring, helpful, thoughtful, a hard worker and provider. She loved football. She coached a local team. She was mad for Elvis. She was 20. Teresa MacDonald, the focal point of her family. She was brave. She stood up for what she believed in and she loved all animals. She was 16. Gerard McGrath, independent and full of energy, talented with his hands, a dapper music lover. He had a passion for the natural world and a love of birds. He was 21. Caroline McHugh, an avid reader, Irish dancer, swimmer, a member of the local CB radio club who did well in school and work. She was 17. James Miller, a sailor who travelled the world, so happy to be engaged, to be married and ready to settle down and raise his family. He was 20. Susan Morgan, a tomboy who loved football and walks and Dublin. She was bubbly, she was funny, she was full of life. She was 19. David Morton, football mad and named Chesty for preferring to receive the ball there than have it mess up his hair. He was mischievous, he was charismatic, he was independent and he had big dreams for the future. He was 19. Kathleen Muldoon, good-natured, thoughtful. She wanted to be a nurse and cared for all those around her. She was 19. George O'Connor, a gentle homebody with a creative spirit. He loved science fiction. He was attending his very first dance. He was 17. Brendan O'Mara, talented Irish dancer and sportsman. He'd help anyone out in any way he could and never had a hair out of place. He was 23. John Stout, sensitive, gentle, also an Elvis fan. He likes snooker. He plans to become a painter and decorator to contribute to the family household that he loved. He was 18. Margaret Thornton, a lover of fashion, music, skilled in dressmaking and tailoring. She loved the pictures, concerts, and especially discos. She was 19. Paul Wade, a people person, good at chatting. He made friends easily, someone you simply couldn't stay mad at. He was 17. Today, that's Cian Corla, we think as well of the hundreds of people who were injured and who were scarred forever, physically and mentally, scarred by fire and scarred by survival. We think of the people working in the Stardust, the waiters, the waitresses, the doormen, the DJs. We think of the frontline workers who fought to save lives on the night, the fire crews, the ambulance and hospital staff, the Gardaí, the army, the taxi drivers. And I want to acknowledge those who came forward many years later and told their stories at the inquest. I want to acknowledge the Dublin communities who were good neighbours to the Stardust families and communities right across Ireland who supported them for 43 years. 43 years since the momentous, devastating loss that was experienced in those early hours of Valentine's Day, 1981. Families who had last seen their loved ones getting dressed up in their best freshly pressed outfits, getting ready to meet friends, going out for a dance, suddenly hearing of a fire in the Stardust, or the sound of sirens, or the knock on the door. And then the escalating panic as the realisation dawned that a disaster was unfolding, to the desperation of searching, of hoping, of praying that your family member or friend had left, had escaped, somehow wasn't there when the fire started and spread, to the frantic rounds of the Stardust car park, the hospitals and the morgue, to the dismay of confirming the identity of lost loved ones by recognising melted jewellery or an engagement ring or a wedding ring, clothing or a digital watch. With a loved one's name replaced by a number or that dreaded label, unidentified, or waiting many years for confirmation of identity long after the agonising pain of loss. And the dreadful aftermath, the body bags, the numbers, the rushed funerals, the closed coffins, the shattering of families, every subsequent event marred and scarred, tainted and tarnished. The surviving children whose rearing years were done through a sea of tears. Mothers afraid to hug, afraid to love, in fear of losing another child. Broken hearts, broken lives, broken marriages. Being accused of telling lies, the smear of arson attached to their loved ones, having their grief and their sadness misconstrued as madness, a sense of threat and suppression when they simply started looking for answers. Stigma heaped upon sorrow bred shame and silence. The intergenerational and communal ripple effect of so much agony and the lack of closure. The families gathered here today and their loved ones who perished, the family members who are no longer with us, and all those who suffered horrific injuries were the victims of a mass tragedy. In such shattering circumstances, the most basic expectation must surely be that the state comes to the aid of its citizens and supports them in the terrible aftermath. Instead, it is to our great and eternal shame that far from the warm embrace of a caring state, the Stardust families experienced a cold shoulder, a deaf ear, and two generations of struggle for truth and justice. Instead, it is to our great shame that state processes heaped misery upon tragedy for the Stardust families. I am so deeply sorry that your first bid for justice ended with suspicion being cast on those who had died or survived on that catastrophic night. With your pain and your grief compounded by stigma and rejection, families were forced to fight for decades to obtain the vindication that you won last Thursday when the inquest returned a verdict of unlawful killing in the case of your 48 family members. For all of this, as Taoiseach, on behalf of this state, I apologise unreservedly to all the families of the Stardust victims and all the survivors for the hurt that was done to them and for the profoundly painful years of struggle for the truth. I apologise to the families that those present on the night of the fire were wrongly criminalised through the allegation of arson, which was an attack on their reputations. I say today clearly in Dáil Éireann, every person there was innocent. I say today the truth is now known, and I say today not only were they innocent, they were unlawfully killed. The government accepts the findings of the coroner's court. The government accepts the recommendations of the jury. This was formally noted at our cabinet meeting this morning, and the Minister for Justice and other relevant ministers have been asked to report back on the implementation of its recommendations. I've asked my own department to prepare proposals to appropriately commemorate the disaster as requested by the families, and I look forward to engaging with and agreeing a way forward with the families on this. Last Saturday, when I met with you here in government buildings, I listened to the pain, the grief, and the righteous anger. It is beyond comprehension how, in the midst of horrific suffering, you found the endurance and the fortitude to form the Stardust Victims Committee and start your long, long fight. But that moment has led to this one. This moment where we say your loved ones are no longer lost in the smoke and the dark and the fire, but are brought back into the light. Where we fulfil the promise of the proclamation of a republic and say without question, they are our cherished children. I want to pay tribute to three of the women who sat in that cold hush outside government buildings 15 years ago who are here with us today. Gertrude Barrett, Antoinette Keegan and Bridget McDermott. Their incredible spirit in refusing to be kept out in the cold helped lead us to this moment today. However, very sadly, a fourth woman who was there, Christine Keegan, and her late husband John, didn't live to see this day. I want to turn to the words of Christine and the questions that she asked, which was never answered in her lifetime. Christine said in a statement she prepared for the inquest, but that she never got to deliver, "The Stardust fire took all our happy family days away from us. It took away all our belief in faith, and it took away our trust with successive governments over the years. We felt abandoned and all alone, and left like lambs to a slaughter. Everything brushed under the carpet to keep the truth hidden." I would like to ask a question to the government, the establishment and its agencies. What did we families of the deceased victims of the Stardust fire ever do on the government to deserve this ill treatment and constant systemic abuse that we have sustained for the past 38 years? Today I want to answer that question. You did nothing wrong. The institutions of this state failed you. The institutions of this state let you down. These brave families should never have had to walk alone. We should have been by your side. We should have walked with you. We were not. We did not. And for that, we are truly sorry. We should have offered counselling. We should have provided answers. We should have ensured that the truth came out. as Christy Moore recognised in his powerful song about the tragedy. The victims waited in vain, except it wasn't for 4 years, it was for 43. Today, we honour the 48 children who never came home. Today, we apologise to the families, to the survivors, to those who were denied the truth for too long. I want to thank the inquest jury for delivering a just verdict last Thursday. I want to thank the senior coroner, Dr. Myra Cullinan, for her sensitive and meticulous conduct of the inquest. The terrible reality is that we will never know for certain how many lives were ended by this tragedy. Beyond the 48 whose names we know, there were countless others whose lives were turned to ash on that terrible, terrible night. Their hopes and their dreams were destroyed twice over. First by the fire, and then by successive failures of this state to do what was right. And for that, I am truly sorry.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And the leader of the Green Party, Eamon Ryan, TD, is now adding to the Taoiseach's apology. And as he said to the families, you were forced to endure a living nightmare. The state failed you when you needed us most. And I know you thought this day would never come. You endured a living nightmare, which began when your loved ones were snatched from you in the devastating fire. I am truly sorry you were made to fight for so long and they went to their graves never knowing the truth. Today we say formally and without any equivocation, we are sorry. We failed you when you needed us most from the very beginning. We should have stood with you, but instead we forced you to stand against us. Tommy Brahan is the former TD who was involved in the campaign for many, many years. Tommy, your initial reaction to the apology?
Well, Joe, I welcome the whole tenor of the Taoiseach's apology, his unreserved apology, and the fact that, you know, he recognises that the families of the Stardust victims and the people who attended that night, that they did walk alone for the best part of four decades, and that the state, which should have been supporting them, didn't in fact do so. So I hope the apology meets the Mr. Darren Mackin and the solicitor representing families at the inquest, that he would have required, and that you know, we will see development in relation to that to help all people who suffered so badly for so long.
And well, he didn't mince his words. The institutions of the state failed you. They let you down and again and again. I am truly sorry. I am so deeply sorry. Forced you, had to endure suspicion then you of the arson suggestion or probability as per the Keane report, and then the stigma. And he said it is to our great and eternal shame that the state gave you the cold shoulder and the deaf ear, and misery was poured upon tragedy. Well, there was no ambivalence in it, Tommy, was there?
No, but I mean, we do recall, I suppose, that the years leading down, in particular to the 25th anniversary and down to 2009, that we thought at that stage that we were reaching, you know, this particular verdict at that particular time when Judge Paul Coffey was given the task of bringing in a review and a report. And it does seem, for example, one example of the state setting its face against the people is that the first draft of Judge Coffey's report seemed to indicate that we would get a full commission of inquiry or a reopening at the inquest. But when the actual final report came through the Department of Justice, what we found then, of course, is that while it removed the slur on the young people that there had been arson, it didn't, you know, it didn't offer the whole provision of a new commission of investigation. So there were so many points like that in the struggle, or when party leaders like Enda Kenny and Eamon Gilmore committed to bringing in a commission investigation in the 2011 election, and then as the years went on, absolutely nothing happened. So today, from that point of view, is momentous.
Yeah, it surely is, and words are powerful. They are powerful, and words on on the Dáil Record, and it's not the first time the names of the 48 victims have been read into the Dáil Record, because you did it previously, I know, Tommy.
I didn't,
but another edition today, and it's been as you know and I know, Tommy, the family of Caroline Carey revealed a long time ago that she was pregnant when she died, and the Taoiseach acknowledged that today, and he said Caroline's unborn child should be regarded as the 49th victim of the Stardust disaster. Helen McSherry, 51551 joe@rt.ie. Helen McSherry, Helen, good afternoon. You were a student nurse in Jervis Street Hospital on that awful night.
That's it, Joe, I was indeed.
And what are your memories?
Oh, well, my memories really are how horrific it was, because the people coming in were the same age as me, and some of them, you know, were thankfully still alive, others weren't. So it certainly was a horrific night.
Yeah. And what age were you, Helen? You were quite young.
I was 18 myself.
The same age as the people you were treating for burns and horrific injuries.
Exactly. That was it, unfortunately. And I'm just after listening to the speech there, and it's thankfully it took a long time, but at least the families are getting some recognition now, which certainly they do deserve.
Yeah,
and it was a terrible night and had a terrible impact on everybody, I think.
And in fairness, the Taoiseach delivered it with great composure, which is extraordinarily difficult to do, but extraordinary. But he did it with great composure, which is a point also to his longevity. And I know he's a very young man, but his longevity in politics.
Absolutely. I mean, and he delivered it with great empathy towards the people who died and to their families. So, you know, that's well deserved for them.
Okay. Helen, did you get any counselling afterwards?
No, actually, we didn't.
Yeah.
Which is.
Well, have you ever? I know that there's never an easy night in a hospital, but have you ever, a day? Have you ever lived through a night like it?
No.
Yeah.
That was my first introduction, really, to anything as horrific as that, and thankfully I've never had to deal with anything as bad as that again.
Yeah.
You know, so it just it's something you never forget, and then because it has taken so long, you know, I mean, we certainly on the night, the first person that arrived with us was one of the first people out and told us that the fire started in the roof and that the doors were locked.
Yeah.
And that, that many years ago, you know, so it's unbelievable that it has taken this length for it to be.
Okay, well, so that's Helen McSherry. Did you become a nurse subsequently?
I still am.
Great, brilliant.
Still am.
Well, thank you for your service, Helen, and
Thanks,
your humanity.
Joe.
It's Helen McSherry. Damien Mulcairns. Damien, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
What's your reaction to the apology by the Taoiseach? It lasted about 24 minutes, I suppose. 48 victims, and he named them all and gave a little pen picture of them, including the unborn child of Caroline Carey. Your reaction to the apology, Damien?
I think, in all fairness, you know, the Taoiseach did very well, you know, but it's just unfortunate that it took so long to come about, Joe, you know, and for the families and everybody involved in the Stardust tragedy. Like, you know, it's just, you know, why did it take so long? But at least finally, hopefully, they can take some solace in what with the inquest results last week and the Taoiseach's apology today on behalf of the state.
And I mentioned earlier, because it has been forgotten, the memorial to the Stardust victims in Beaumont Hospital. You had occasion to see it and unfortunately sit with it in your own difficult times.
That's right, Joe. Unfortunately, my eldest brother Kenneth, he was taken to Beaumont Hospital in 1991. seriously ill with a brain hemorrhage. Now, he did survive in the hospital for a number of weeks, you know, but I was 15 at the time, and I remember the memorial so well, and I don't know what it did, but I used to go down and just sit at it and read the names and read the poem, and it just gave me some sort of solace. I don't know why or what it did, but it always sticks in my head, and even the poem, They Never Grow Old, it was used at Kenneth's funeral mass, you know, so it had a lifelong effect on me. It's just something that's always been in the back of my mind, you know, and just that, I suppose, as a 15-year-old, it just stuck in my head, you know.
And your brother was only 22.
That's right, Joe, just 22. He was my eldest brother. He had a great job in Dublin and that, you know. And he's missed ever since. And it's like, you know, anybody, it's like all the families, they, like, you know, they've reached a milestone with regards to the state apology and the inquest results and things like that. But they're never going to get over this, you know. It's something that's just, you know, it's but please God that it'll go, give them some sort of, you know, just relief, and that they can now finally move on with their lives, you know.
And the words of that piece, which are inscribed, as you say, in the grounds of Beaumont Hospital. As I'm reminding people, that you go through the main reception area, keep going to the right towards the shop and the canteen, and the hospital wards, and then on the left-hand side, you can look at it through the glass. Now, depending on the time of year, the foliage can, and that's nature, can cover it, but that plaque on lying on the ground and surrounded on the wall by
the victims' names are on plaques then,
And they're all listed alphabetically, and the poem...
Yeah, I can still see it now in my head, you know.
And the poem you read then, at the same piece you read, they shall never grow old, as we that are left grow old, age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn, at the going down of the sun, and in the morning we shall remember them. God rest Kenneth and everyone who dies too young, Damien, too young.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate that.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Well, the reaction we're getting so far to the Taoiseach's speech and very strong apology to the families, survivors, and indeed the victims of the Stardust fire tragedy is that the speech was dignified, that it didn't pull its punches, that it was delivered very calmly. The fact that the Taoiseach read out the 48, indeed 49, he referred to 49 people, the unborn child of Caroline Carey, who we've known about before, but it's the first time that the baby has been referred to in the Dáil, and that brings the number to 49 in terms of the victims, which reminds me, I don't know whether people remember, the other great tragedy in this city and indeed in this country is the Dublin bombing of May the 17th, 1974, when 34 people were killed, and also Monaghan bombing as well. And there was a bombing shortly thereafter in Dundalk and indeed Belturbet. But on the memorial to the Dublin bombing at the junction of Talbot Street and Amien Street, that number has been added to by the fact that Colette Doherty, one of the victims of the Dublin bombing, we always read that 33 people died, but Colette, it was subsequently revealed, was 9 months pregnant, and I've spoken to her daughter on a number of occasions, who was with her. She was in the pram, and her mother was returning from the rotunda, where she was told, Colette was told to go home. She lived just off Amien Street, to bring her daughter home and to come straight back to rotunda because she was about to give birth, and that she wanted to bring her daughter home. And on her way home, the explosion happened, that the bomb happened outside Guiney's there in Talbot Street, and Colette was killed. 32 other people were killed, and Colette's unborn baby was killed. And the coroner subsequently added the unborn baby, Baby Doherty, she's referred to, on the memorial in Talbot Street. That brought it up to 35. And Edward O'Neill, whose father, Eddie O'Neill, Edward O'Neill Jr., great, great campaigner, great, great man for the Dublin campaign over the years, and just a very decent human being given the tragedy he went through. Edward was with his family in Parnell Street, and then subsequently Edward was killed, his father was killed, young Edward was severely injured, and Martha, who was Eddie's mother, Martha had a stillbirth shortly thereafter, and that number was added to in the Dublin bombings, bringing up to 35. And as I say, today the Taoiseach acknowledged the request of the family of Caroline Carey that her baby be acknowledged as the 49th victim. This is just a clip of the Taoiseach.
Today we say formally and without any equivocation, we are sorry. We failed you when you needed us the most. From the very beginning, we should have stood with you, but instead, we forced you to stand against us. 48 young people lost their lives in the Stardust disaster. Many more were injured, and even more still had their lives broken and shattered forever.
And that was just an extract from what the Taoiseach said. It lasted, as I say, about 24 minutes on this day. I'm deeply sorry you were made to fight for so long. We failed you when you needed us most. And the Taoiseach recalled at one stage when the families were trying to be heard and fighting for another inquiry, be it an inquest, a tribunal or a commission. They actually tried to get into the Dáil and were refused, and they sat in the security hut, you all know it, there at the gates in Kildare Street. Four of them sat, and one of the people who stayed in that room was another remarkable woman called Bridget McDermott. And Bridget lost three children in the Stardust. Bridget's husband, as I met a firefighter, a friend of mine this morning, Noel Cunningham, and he was reminding me that George McDermott, who was a Dublin firefighter, he wasn't on duty that night, but he lost three of his children, believe it or not, in that fire. And George and Bridget were the parents, Marcella McDermott, Willie McDermott, and as he was known, Georgie McDermott. And Willie was unlawfully killed when he went back in to try and rescue his two siblings, Marcella, who was unlawfully killed, and George, who was unlawfully killed. This is the voice of Bridget McDermott, who was unlawfully grieved and bereaved on that awful night.
He came back and told us that there was a fire. And then my husband got up. He was a fireman, but he should have been on duty that night when he was off. It was a nightmare from then on. A pure nightmare, and still is. Yeah. Our marriage broke up. I said to Jimmy when this happened, we had to get justice. He said, no, I can't do, we can't do that. We haven't the money anyway. And he said, I'd lose my job if I was to go to court, because he was in. Yeah. I thought about it. I couldn't understand that. It not only took my children, but marriage as well. When we were out canvassing years ago, down the country, Canada's looking for money to bring pay for solicitors and everything, and the public couldn't have been nicer to us. They were very good. They helped us immensely everywhere we went. They were. And I thank them for that. I came praying and asked God to spare me till it's all over. All I want is justice.
Let's go straight to Lisa Lawler, who was in the chamber. And Lisa, I've seen the photographs of you entering Dáil Éireann with the bunches of roses. What were you saying with those beautiful bunches of flowers, Lisa?
Well, I suppose, Joe, I was saying that we've reached where we wanted to be, and I bought 49 red roses, actually.
Well done.
Because I bought one for the unborn child was killed in the Stardust as well. And I will say that I'm very, very honoured to be here.
Okay.
I'm very honoured to be inside the chamber.
Yeah.
And I'm very honoured to be here to hear of the victorious moment.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely full of joy and of relief, Joe.
Yeah.
I'm very, very relieved today.
And what was the atmosphere like in the gallery when the Taoiseach was speaking, Lisa?
I was indeed, yeah. I was listening to everything. Yeah, I was indeed. You know, I was very honoured.
And the reaction we're getting here on the phones is that it was a very dignified speech. The fact that that he read it, was that the same reaction in
you know, it was lovely. He gave, you know, a little description of everyone, which was very, very touching, Joe.
Yeah.
You know, it was absolutely beautiful, I have to say. It was very, I'm so honoured to be sitting here today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Lisa, what will you do this afternoon? What did the families do? I just think it's very difficult on all of you. And on the one hand, very important that you hear that full apology. But what happens next, Lisa?
You know, we come together with our legal team, and we wouldn't have got through this without Darren Mackin. We wouldn't have got through this without Phoenix Law. They've been there every hand's turn, every step of the way for us in every single sense. So we'll discuss that later on, and we'll see where we go.
Okay. Well, Lisa, I hope, and I think you do know that you'll never walk alone again. Never.
I do know that now, Joe. I most definitely do know that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you and all the families for what you've done over the years. You've never, and I know you were only a baby in a cot when
I mean, I know, like, being the Stardust baby, I mean, it's come with a lot of difficulty, I may say, but it's also come with a lot of honour. And I'm honoured today, and they're vindicated, and I'm very, very happy.
Yeah. And your father and mother, who died that night, they will always be remembered.
God loved them.
Yeah, Francis and Maureen.
Francis and the beautiful Maureen. They will be always remembered and never forgotten.
Okay. Lisa, you mind yourself. Mind yourself.
Thank you
please.
Very much, yes, Joe. Thank you.
Mind
you.
Yourself.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, thank you. Weldon Costello. Weldon, you spoke movingly to us on Friday about your memories and the neighbour and the family, the three McDermotts who died. What was your reaction to the speech by the Taoiseach?
Good afternoon, Joe, and thank you for reaching out to me today and asking me to come back on. I think it was a very heartfelt apology from Simon, very from the bottom of his heart. I'm hoping that it could have went a little bit more for the apologies for the 43 years that they had to walk the streets, but at least the state has said they turned their back on them. They should have been there for them. He was at that memorial last night for a full 20 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
And what he said there today was from his own feelings.
Okay.
And that it was touching, it was there. And I hope that the state of Ireland now stands behind the 48 families and keeps this going to educate our educators that this happened. This has been the worst tragedy in the history of the state.
Yeah.
And let it not happen again. To all those 48 families, my thoughts and prayers are with you today. You have got your apology, and it has been a long time coming, Joe.
But it says, well, then it also, and you will, it says something that the Taoiseach, who delivered the apology, and as I say, I think that there's a universal appreciation of it.
Yes.
But the Taoiseach was born 5.5 years after this disaster.
He's the same age as my nephew. And
that's how long it's taken the state to apologise.
Exactly. Nearly half a century. You know, you can't put it into words. Look, it has taken 43 years of hail, rain and snow for the women and fathers and family of the victims that were unlawfully killed.
Yeah.
Right? They have to be said. And they must be repeated.
And
they must have been unlawfully.
And they must be engraved in stone in perpetuity.
In perpetuity of this, this wonderful nation of ours. But we must not forget that they were 48 children of this nation.
Yeah.
A very nation that the government turns their back on until today.
Okay, well said again.
That's what I said. Thank you very much, Joe.
Okay, thank you. Well done.
God bless. And bye-bye.
All those who have contributed over the last three full days. We remember the song that the families asked programmes like us to play is You'll Never Walk Alone. Today's producer is Sian O'Gorman.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.